This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, the 5th of July, 2011. In San Francisco, I'm Danny Wood. Coming up on the newscast, tanks surround the Syrian city of Hama as security forces raid homes, arrest residents, and shoot and kill protesters. In Thailand, after the weekend's elections, a new government is forming under the country's first female prime minister. And we look at protests by nomadic herdsmen in southern Mongolia against coal and lead mines.
I believe similar protests will continue in order to reclaim the way of life and their national identity. Also, they're defending their basic human rights and fundamental freedom.
Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Shannon Young with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Tens of thousands of civilians are fleeing southern Yemen as the government of long-ruling President Ali Abdullah Saleh uses warplanes to bombard an area that has reportedly been taken over by militants. Pro-democracy protesters have been calling for Saleh's resignation since January, but the U.S. has been hesitant to back their demands. Yemeni security forces detained two opposition figures at the capital's international airport today. President Saleh is in Saudi Arabia, recovering from an assassination attempt, but has made no indication that he will step down. Meanwhile, Saudi Arabia is seeking to expand its arsenal. The German government is facing sharp criticism for its decision last week to close a deal selling 200 tanks to the oil-rich kingdom. Cinnamon Nippard has more from Berlin.
The Saudi government has been trying to buy German tanks for the past 30 years. Under the multi-billion euro deal, they've already bought 44. But opponents of the deal say it contravenes Germany's weapons export guidelines, which prevented arms manufacturers from selling weapons to countries in crisis regions, with human rights problems, or engaged in armed conflicts. Senior Greens MP Katia Coyle said that selling 200 Leopard tanks to Saudi Arabia is far from ethical foreign policy. "The country is in the middle of a regional powder keg. You shouldn't be giving out matches there," she said. Saudi Arabia's military played a key role in crushing pro-reform demonstrations earlier this year in Bahrain. The deal also comes as Saudi women campaign for the right to drive, and rare protests call for the release of hundreds of political prisoners. Opponents of the German-Saudi arms deal warn the Saudi government may use the weapons to crush protests. The Saudi government is also negotiating with US companies for $60 billion worth of defense equipment, which would include 84 F-15 fighter jets and 178 combat helicopters. If it goes through, it will become the largest single US arms contract ever. Cinnamon Nippard, FSRN, Berlin.
A double bombing in a town north of Baghdad has killed at least 35 people and injured more than 50. A wave of smaller yet deadly attacks, mostly from booby-trapped cars, occurred over the weekend. The uptick in violence comes as politicians are due to discuss a pending hydrocarbons law, as well as a proposal to extend the U.S. military presence in Iraq. An Israeli airstrike has killed two men in central Gaza. Rami Al-Megari has the details.
Relatives and friends of those hit in Tuesday afternoon's airstrike screamed in the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital in central Gaza Strip as they learned two of the men had died and a third was wounded. The Israeli army says the airstrike targeted a group of militants to the east of Al-Musaddar village in the central Gaza Strip who were planning to fire rockets into nearby Israeli areas. Palestinian medical sources say the two are identified as Mohammed Abu Jazar and Kamal Abu Muammar, while a third, unnamed, was severely injured. Today's airstrike is the second in the Gaza Strip since an Israeli offensive in March killed 19 Palestinians, including 7 civilians, and wounded many others. While Gaza has lived in relative calm for the past 4 months, today's airstrike comes as an international solidarity flotilla has been prevented from reaching Gaza's shores. Rami Al-Megari, Free Speech Radio News, Gaza.
Tens of thousands of gallons of oil spilled from a ruptured pipeline into the Yellowstone River in Montana over the weekend. The faulty pipeline is operated by oil giant ExxonMobil. Crews are now in the area trying to clean up the spill, although floodwaters have carried contamination onto nearby farms and ranch lands. The company claims no more than 1,000 barrels of crude oil spilled into the river before it shut down the flow through the pipeline. The spill had little impact on ExxonMobil's stock prices today. The company often ranks as the most profitable in the world. And finally, a hunger strike that started on Friday at California's Pelican Bay prison has expanded to other facilities. The action began with dozens of prisoners in an isolation unit refusing their food trays. They are protesting conditions in the facility and a lack of medical care. Their list of demands includes the provision of adequate and nutritious food, greater access to phone calls, visits, and educational materials, and an end to long-term solitary confinement. The hunger strike has reportedly spread to Pelican Bay's general population, into five other California prisons, and the Ohio State Penitentiary. And those are some of today's headlines. I'm Shannon Young.
I'm Danny Wood in San Francisco. In the Syrian city of Hama today, tanks have surrounded the city and security forces using live ammunition raided homes, arrested residents, and killed at least six people. This follows yesterday's attacks by security forces that killed three and injured about 20. Speaking through an interpreter, a witness described to Al Jazeera what he saw during yesterday's violence.
The security, fully and heavily armed, encountered the anti-regime demonstrations and started to fire randomly at all people. At that point, the people started to gather around the hospital as they rushed the victims to the hospitals. They started to gather in order to protect the victims and the injured at the hospitals as the security wanted to crack down on the hospitals.
Among those treated for injuries in the attacks, the Syrian heavyweight boxer Nasser al-Shami, who won a bronze medal at the 2004 Olympics. On Friday, there were massive anti-government demonstrations in the city by tens of thousands of people, possibly the largest so far against the rule of President Bashar al-Assad. Several videos purport to show protesters being shot over the weekend. Hama is seen as a symbolic bastion of anti-government resistance because in 1982 Syria's former ruler and al-Assad's father ordered a crackdown that killed many thousands. Protests continued in cities and towns across the country over the weekend and into Monday and Tuesday. This amateur video uploaded to YouTube shows many hundreds of people last night allegedly rallying in Homs Freedom Square. Since anti-government protests began, human rights groups say more than 1,300 people have been killed and many thousands more injured and arrested. Meanwhile, France is calling for tougher action against Syria. A statement from the French Foreign Ministry called on the UN Security Council to stand up against what it described as unacceptable armed repression. In the port of Athens in Greece, it's been a tense few days for the passengers of the Gaza Freedom Flotilla. There were demonstrations, arrests, standoffs at sea, and a ceremony in Gaza. From Washington, D.C., Alice Olstein reports.
On Friday, the Greek Coast Guard stopped the Audacity of Hope just 20 minutes after leaving the Athens port. While activist Johnny Barber filmed the confrontation, Captain John Klusmeyer shouted across the water to the heavily armed officers.
The paperwork is in order. Okay. I am following the law.
Captain Klusmeyer was arrested and jailed for endangering passenger safety and blocking sea traffic. The Audacity of Hope was forced to return to the Athens port and is currently impounded. Then, on Sunday night, nine passengers began a fast in front of the U.S. Embassy in Athens. Police arrested them for blocking the sidewalk. On Monday, police arrested six of the same people on a park bench across from the residence of the U.S. ambassador to Greece. Both times, they were released within a few hours. Retired U.S. veteran Anne Wright spoke from Greece on Tuesday about this 4th of July irony.
They were actually detained two times in a 24-hour period in front of the U.S. embassies. So much for freedom of expression and freedom of assembly in front of the U.S. embassy by American citizens on Independence Day.
Captain Kluzmeier was released without bail Tuesday afternoon after 4 days in custody. Wright and the other passengers hope the charges against him will be dropped.
They're politically motivated charges. They really have nothing to do with the competency of you as a captain nor the seaworthiness of our vessel.
Meanwhile, in Gaza, locals and international visitors gathered Saturday for a symbolic ceremony for the stalled flotilla at the Gaza seaport. Children sailed boats flying flags from the countries of the flotilla's participants, while activists demanded free access of the ships into Gaza. 24-year-old Mohammed Matar says Israeli officials have a hand in trying to stop the ships.
They don't want anybody to talk about Palestine. They want Palestine to be forgotten. But like all the initiatives are going to be like lost because like what they're doing is not... It's not possible to stop the real movement that is happening toward breaking the siege over Gaza Strip.
But not all agree. Jonathan Schanzer is an analyst with the counterterrorism think tank, Foundation for the Defense of Democracies.
I think the idea of having individuals trying to break military policy that has been created by a government is sort of an extreme position. I think that the very idea of providing goods to a country that is controlled or a territory that is controlled by a terrorist organization, I think, constitutes material support to terrorist organizations.
While Schanzer calls the flotilla ill-advised, Rabbi Alyssa Weiss from Jewish Voice for Peace says the activists are motivated to take these risks for a reason.
The flotilla is a really important opportunity to keep the conversation on Gaza and to ask hard questions about what's happening in Gaza, why so many activists across the world felt the need to create this flotilla and this, what I do think of as the modern-day freedom rides.
The Canadian boat in the flotilla was setting out for international waters on Monday when Greek special forces stopped them. While being towed back to the dock, the boat, named Tahrir, hit a concrete wall and sustained severe damage. All eyes are now on the French boat, the Dignité Al-Karama, which managed to leave Corsica Tuesday afternoon, sailing towards Gaza. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington, D.C.
A new Thai government is forming, led by Yingluck Shinawat, who is set to become the country's first female prime minister. Yingluck comes to power after her party won the weekend's elections with a campaign focused on political reconciliation and economic recovery. From Bangkok, Ron Corbin reports.
After a weekend election victory, Thailand's Pua Thai Party, led by Yingluck Shinawat, moved quickly to present a five-party coalition government. In a landslide victory from Sunday's vote, unofficial results show the opposition Pua Thai Party won 264 seats in the 500-member parliament, with coalition partners set to lift the number to 300 seats. The Asian Network for Free Elections, with representatives from countries across Asia-Pacific, observed the vote and said polling took place in a peaceful and orderly way based on the rule of law. The victory was celebrated by Pua Thai supporters, especially in northern provinces, home of the Shinawat family.
Yes, very much. It's important for the country, future of the country. So we have to accept the people's choice.
As the Pua Thai victory became evident, the governing Democrat Party of Prime Minister Pisit Wechichoa soon conceded defeat. Pisit said the initial results showed the party had fallen short of its 2007 election performance. As a result, he was taking responsibility for the defeat and resigning as leader of the Democrat Party. Yingluck, a 44-year-old businesswoman, is the younger sister of former telecom billionaire Thaksin Shinawat. Thaksin, ousted in a coup in 2006, has spent significant sums to finance an anti-government movement known as the United Democratic Front Against Dictatorship, or UDD. UDD Thaksin supporters are known as the Red Shirts. Last year, UDD-led protests eventually triggered a military crackdown. In 2 months of violence, over 90 people died, the worst political turbulence in 20 years. At a press conference, Yingluck said the new government's goal would be to solve the problems faced by the people.
Now,
Yingluck says the Pu'atai and the other parties have the same intentions to administer the country and work to solve the problems of the people. But she said they were still waiting on official results expected mid-July from the country's election commission. Kok Kau Pik Lutong, a Pu'atai member and former Red Shirt leader, says the government's main priorities will be reconciliation and economic recovery.
The government have to push very hard to make Thai people be united again. The second thing, the government have to release the burdens of the Thai people, especially for the cost of living. Now the income cannot cover the cost of living.
But some have concerns about how the government will move to implement its policy platform. The English-language Bangkok Post newspaper says the new government is preparing an amnesty bill for parliament to clear Thaksin of corruption charges. Krisak Chunawan, a Democrat Party member, says any moves by Pu'atai Party to press on with an amnesty for Thaksin will be controversial.
You cannot come out with a amnesty for one person. It has to be a social thing. For instance, if Mr. Thaksin is charged on corruption, one charge or two charges, a law to give amnesty to him on that means from now on corruption will be legal.
Thaksin lives in exile in Dubai but still faces a 2-year jail sentence for corruption. It remains uncertain whether Thaksin will seek to stay abroad or whether he'll influence the new government. But analysts say any moves by Thaksin to return to Thailand in the near term could trigger fresh conflicts. Ron Corbin, FSRN, Bangkok.
In Chinese-governed southern Mongolia, many hundreds of students and nomadic ethnic Mongolian herders have been protesting coal and lead mining operations. Residents say it's damaging the environment, livelihoods, and health of local people. According to human rights observers, the most recent protest was sparked by the expansion of a lead mine onto grazing land. In response, Chinese riot police beat and detained a number of protesters. For more, we go to the director of New York-based Southern Mongolian Human Rights Information Center, Enkbat Tarchuk. Welcome to Free Speech Radio News.
Thank you.
Can you tell us firstly about this lead mine and what residents and herders there are concerned about?
The Mongolian peoples, Mongolian herders in the surrounding area of the lead mine is concerned about their safety, their health and their livestock, their grassland, their grazing land, and also their water. So most importantly, they are concerned about their traditional way of life and their national identity, the nomadic way of life, which has been threatened by the mining operation, also the Chinese authorities' policy of the so-called ecological migration and livestock grazing ban.
Herders say that this mine is discharging toxic waste into the environment and some of their livestock have died. And they're also concerned, understandably, about the health of their people. Do you know if this mine is regulated by any sort of environmental agency and who's responsible for it and what residents can do in a situation like this if they want to complain?
Well, there are certainly some government bodies are supervising the mining operation, but the problem is in reality the Chinese laws are not really enforced, and those mining companies are just dumping their toxic waste onto the grazing grassland and Mongolian herders grazing land without any treatment. So the local herders petitioned the levels of local government many times since 1985 when the particular mine was started operating, but the local authorities did not really resolve the issue, and recently the Mongolian herders really do not have any the grazing lands to move around. So they just get close to the mine, and then they started having conflict with the mining the mining company. And then starting June 11th, they the petition the local township government, also the Banner government many times, and but the government did not answer, so they did not respond to their petition. So they started marching toward the mining company, and on June 24th, they managed to shut down one of the water pumps in the mining company, so in the mine. Then on the second day, June 25th, the local authority dispatched more than 50 police, and they cracked down on them. Many Mongolian herders were beaten up and arrested, and their current condition and whereabouts are still unknown.
I also understand that in one of those protests earlier, a herder was killed. Can you tell us anything more on what happened exactly to that herder who was killed?
Yes, there have been a large scale of protests by the Mongolian herders and the Mongolian students and in May in many different places. These protests are sparked by the brutal killing of a Mongolian herder named Mr. Murgun, who was killed by a Chinese truck driver. The truck driver intentionally killed him, and then before the truck driver killing him, he also stated that killing a smelly herder doesn't cost me 400,000 yuan. So after this brutal killing, Mongolian students and herders marched toward the local government building. After that, many protests took place in many different places, and including in the regional capital, Luo Hao City. And the Chinese government mobilized a large number of paramilitary forces and riot police to crack down on them. The situation is pretty tense in major cities of the autonomous region right now.
The impact of coal and lead mining on Mongol herdsmen has been an issue for many years in Chinese-governed inner or southern Mongolia. How significant do you see this recent unrest, and how is it adding to ethnic tensions with the Chinese authorities?
The latest development, the latest protest, is a continuation of, it's a part of the larger protest took place since May, and I believe the similar protests will continue in a much larger size and in a much stronger manner in order to reclaim their traditional way of life and their national identity. Also, they're defending their basic human rights and fundamental freedom.
Angbat Tarchuk, director of the Southern Mongolian Human Rights Information Center based in New York, thanks very much for your time.
My pleasure.
An organic farm on Washington State's Olympic Peninsula is trying to reinvigorate the country's aging population of organic farmers with new, younger blood to ensure the industry's future. Many organic and conventional farmers are pushing 60 years old, but for the last 15 years, this Washington State farm has targeted young people interested in learning the art of organic farming. Now they plan to offer shares of land to this new generation of organic farmers. Martha Baskin reports.
It's Kia Armstrong's weekend to sell organic produce at a farmer's market in Seattle. She helped grow and harvest every item on display. Grains such as rye and barley, radishes, Jerusalem artichoke, spinach, and garlic scapes. A customer takes a closer look.
We were trying to figure out like what they grow off of.
So in the early summer, the garlic plants that we planted last fall are going to seed, and they send up this tall flowering shoot. And they're great grills. I like to put them in the pan with some butter in the morning and then crack an egg into it.
You made it sound very appealing. We're giving it a shot.
8 years ago, Armstrong got a job at Nash's Organic Farm on Washington's Olympic Peninsula. The 32-year-old farmer has never looked back.
The power food is amazing, and I feel real lucky to be a part of a healthy food system that gets life-giving food to people, you know. To me, that's what it's all about. It's about empowering our community so that we can continue to grow food together.
They sell direct at 11 farmers markets and 3 wholesale companies. The farm's unique microclimate in the rich, Dungeness River Valley enables them to grow year-round. But it's access to land that has allowed the farm to diversify and what will allow the farm to hand off shares to those who've helped it grow. Nash Huber and his wife Patty started with 10 acres 20 years ago. Kia Armstrong says Huber always had his eye on other pieces of land and kept track of how quickly houses were cropping up.
He started to build relationships with local landowners, and like I say, the PCC Farmland Trust really set the tone for people stepping up to the plate and saving land.
PCC Farmland Trust is a nonprofit dedicated to preserving farmland. They bought more than 170 acres 10 years ago when Huber approached them to find a way to fight land grabbing by developers. Rebecca Sandinsky with PCC Farmland Trust.
The mechanism that the land trusts around the country use is something called a conservation easement. So a conservation easement buys down the development potential of a piece of land and saying, for here on forward, this land can't be developed for anything other than, and in our case, we say agriculture, specifically organic agriculture.
Following in the footsteps of PCC Farmland Trust, another land trust and others interested in protecting farmland here have purchased easements on 385 acres of this 400-acre farm. The next step, and one the farm hopes to resolve shortly, is how to pass shares of land to the next generation. Nash Huber hired a consultant a couple of years ago and incorporated the farm. I catch up with him on a lunch break.
You have to be able to keep your good people. That's the secret. And we're still struggling with how we want to do that, or how we can do that. Because my goal is not to have a farm auction when I'm gone and my wife has to sell everything. No, that is not. My goal is to see this farm exist for many generations after I'm gone.
But even when Huber figures out the mechanism for passing shares of farmland on, challenges remain. Salary is minimum wage. It goes up slowly. Those who become managers can earn more. Huber won't disclose the exact sum, but says it's close to what average college graduates are earning this year, $27,000. To sweeten the deal, everyone who farms gets all the produce they need and discounts on eggs and pork. Lifestyle and community are what draw most. The second challenge, and a big one, says Huber, is to restructure the way the agricultural economy works. On average, food travels 1,500 to 2,000 miles before it gets to anyone's plate.
We've not approached it from a point of view of producing it ourselves. Most of the food we eat now is imported food. And so we've not thought about who's going to do the work.
The answer, says Huber, is to train people to work hard and teach them to appreciate the meaningful lifestyle farming offers. Community, land beneath your feet, the tastiest food around.
Agriculture is so varied that it has potential to turn you on in whatever way you want to be if you really want to work at it.
With that, he returns to the midweek farm lunch shared by all and prepared with ingredients grown right here on Nash's organic farm. Martha Baskin, FSRN, Seattle.
And that's the program for today. The newscast was produced by Catherine Comp. Headlines editor, Shannon Young. Our Washington, D.C. editor, Alice Olstein. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley is Rose Katapchi and Jane Chang. Thanks to Rami Almagari in Gaza for sound used in our D.C. report. FSRN welcomes your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments@fsrn.org. For more news stories, specials, and our documentaries, visit our website, fsrn.org, and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fsrn. Thanks for listening. In San Francisco, I'm Danny Wood.